spirit of reconciliation, I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. I pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island peoples today. Welcome to Totally Lit, the podcast celebrating reading, writing and creating literature. I'm your host, Kai Garvey. Thank you for listening. My guest this episode is the author of Alphabetta, Better Ways to Be from A to Z, Maura Pirlo. Maura is an author, playwright and filmmaker based in Canberra. Her work across art forms explores the complex intersection between identity, self and belonging. Tackling youth mental health themes, Maura's acclaimed play Fragments is now an award-winning web series supported by the ACT government, a feature-length anthology film and a hybrid young adult novella. Maura enjoys writing creative non-fiction for children. Alphabetta presents fun, relatable scenarios that encourage children to explore positive character traits and values. I hope you enjoy our chat. Maura Pirlo, welcome to Totally Lit. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Kai. It's great to be here.
I'd love to hear about your latest book, Alphabetta. Could you tell me about it, please?
Sure. Alphabetta is a book on values and virtues and positive character traits, different ways of being that kind of will help children make good choices. That's the aim of the book. It's based loosely, not literally, on Aristotle's virtue ethics, which may sound a little bit esoteric to some, but it's really all about looking at positive character traits and ways of being so that we can live what Aristotle would call a good life. It looks at 26 different values, virtues, and character traits alphabetically. Each page includes two synonyms for each value or virtue, in a very clear, brief definition, a very relatable, child-friendly scenario to put that value or virtue in context for them. And then each page also includes an open-ended question, which is designed to spark conversation.
Fantastic. And what age group would it be aimed for?
Well, it's listed for ages 3+. The beauty of the book is it's a very layered book. It's deceptively simple. So you look at it and you see those different components that I mentioned. But within that, there's so much possibility, I guess, for interaction and meaning and context, depending on age of the child and their reading level and also their interests, the family, the context that the book is being used in. It's suitable. It's a great resource for the classroom. But older kids, even when doing the teacher notes, Kelly Nissen at Just Write Words prepared the teacher notes for me. Mm-hmm. And she said, look, there's just so much stuff here across disciplines, across age groups. I think the teacher notes were close to 40 pages, so we had to whittle them down substantially to make them, workable in the classroom. But I think it'll appeal across age groups. I think it'll even appeal to adults, because quite a few have already told me it's almost like a primer, on ethics, and just things that we can do within our life, traits that we can inhabit to live a better life.
And you have a doctorate in ethics, is that correct?
Yeah, it's technically in philosophy, but in the degree we had to concentrate in one area, philosophy, and my interest has always been ethics.
And how did you find translating it from a university level to a level that would appeal to children?
Yeah, it's difficult in the sense that it's not translated directly. Mm-hmm. And it's been a long time since I worked as an academic in philosophy and since my philosophy training. When I first started studying philosophy at an undergraduate level, I think people at the time, this was the 80s, were intrigued, like, oh, that's an interesting choice of degree, because at the time it was very much pre-professionalizing. You need to be an engineer or a doctor. You need to study to get a job. Mm. So I think some people might have thought head in the clouds. And then I continued for a master's, then for a PhD. And by that point, family and friends were saying, like, what on earth are you going to do with these degrees in philosophy? It makes no sense in any reality. So the standing joke was they thought I'd stand on a street corner and pontificate in a robe and sandals like Socrates. That'd be my part-time job, which I would love to bring back the agora, the marketplace, where you actually can speak and people can interact. So I think that's a great way to kind of come to, you know, agreement about contentious issues just by talking through. So there's some merit to that. But I argued then and still now that I can't think of any better discipline to help you think holistically, critically, logically, to be able to analyze and argue effectively, to be open-minded and tolerant of other people's views. It's really the best possible training for life, for any field of interest. And even though I haven't worked for decades in philosophy per se, I've used that training in everything I've done, like personally and professionally. And I'd like to think I've done well as a result of that, because of that training. So to translate it for kids was kind of easy, because it's really just looking at the outlook that we need every day to develop the strength of mind and character to go about thriving in life. And that's what Aristotle thought. He thought what we have in as humans, different to other living beings and creatures, different than plants, different than animals, is we have practical reason. So we can go about our lives assessing and distinguishing between different courses of action to choose the right one. And he thought the point of that, of being human, was to live what he called in a state of eudaimonia, which from the Greek, there's apparently no direct translation. I don't speak Greek. It's often translated as happiness, but a more apt description is probably flourishing or thriving. So this book, Alphabetter, in simple terms, is really a book about character building. How do you develop a good character? How do you become kind? How do you become generous? How do you become courageous? Aristotle's virtue ethics, he believes it's a matter of habit. He thinks we're all born with the disposition to be good. We just need a bit of practice. So a kind person is someone who does kind acts. A courageous person is someone who does courageous acts. And if you do them long enough, well enough, in the right context, they become second nature. So when faced with a choice, you find even subliminally, you're kind of naturally gravitating towards that action that reflects your character and your state of being.
And how did the concept of Alphabetter come together? What made you write the book?
I think over time, I've noticed that philosophies and ethics in particular is very misunderstood. So I feel like a lot of people distance themselves. They think, oh, it's like a moral authority telling us what to do. It's tied up notions of virtue with the church. I grew up in a very Catholic family, both sides. So there was a lot of language attached to that. But virtues, even though they do have grounding in history, in the church and church teachings, and there's nothing wrong with that because many people derive great meaning and purpose in their life through that. But they're also secular and can be embodied and inhabited in a secular sense. So I guess that's the beauty, the really humanistic traits, no matter where we come to access them and how we access them. And I guess over time, I wanted to clarify that to some extent. You know, the book's partly a love letter to philosophy on a personal level, but on a practical level, it's because I felt like the world was becoming increasingly complicated. And our kids, the easy way to explain it, you know, because I don't feel that it's my place to talk in detail about how their brains are wired or not wired. But I could say very categorically that they're all bright kids with heaps of potential, you know, doing well, but they were not great students. So they found it very difficult, I guess, to access, you know, school and things like that. Everyone's just kind of wired a different way. And to get them through school was a mini ordeal in many ways. And as I was becoming increasingly involved from the sidelines in their early school life, they're now in their early to mid-20s, don't need me anymore, I realized, God, we're filling up kids with a lot of knowledge, you know, a lot of tedious bits of information that might be interesting, might come in handy in life, but arguably not, you know, how tectonic plates work. You know, obscure levels of craft and maybe some smattering of this and an introduction to that. But I didn't see at the time, this was like over 10 years ago, that there was really a focus on helping kids to think and helping kids to become better people, to develop the skills and the values that would serve as a foundation. So no matter what life threw with them, they'd be able to navigate better. So they weren't, you know, there's no problem solvers here. It's not the kind of book, oh, if you read it, you know, you'll have no issues, all the answers. But it's just a focus on trying to do what you can within yourself to try to be the kind of person that you would like to be, which is possible. And hey, kids, let's just look holistically at many, 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 many different ways of being, positive states of being that will help you do that. So I think my aim was practical. And the fact that I had a background in the area and that it's always had special meaning to me made it a bit more sweet.
Do you touch on any negative characteristics? So I know that you've talked about 26 virtues. How do you communicate that these characteristics may be better than other characteristics?
The book doesn't look at negative characteristics and it doesn't look at them in relation to positive ones comparatively. There are plans to continue with this. I mean, if I had my way, which I don't because I'm not a publisher, I'd love to keep going and explore things like that. But for now, the focus was on positive character traits. That seemed the simplest, best way to start. Coincidentally, Aristotle thinks that virtues are the mean between two vices. So if you take courage, courage is a virtue. If you're too far the other way, too fearful, you're craven, whatever adjective we want to use, almost incapacitated by fear, that would be an excess and a deficiency. And if you're the other way, where you have no fear whatsoever, you're reckless. So for Aristotle, virtue is striving for the mean. And the mean only makes sense in the context of, I guess, those more negative traits or excesses. But the book doesn't go into that specifically because, again, it's a young audience. It's an introduction. Most of them don't have any exposure to philosophy. So I just wanted to start simple, focus on character building, focus on positivity, focus on growth and becoming the kind of people, you know, that they would like to be, and the same within their friendship groups and within their family.
What reception have you been having to the book so far?
Yeah, very good. It's apparently very early days, but selling extremely well. So I couldn't be more thrilled to hear that. There's been a lot of positive feedback from people who've contacted me, a lot of sharing of stories via DM. And I suppose, you know, a lot of people aren't very comfortable with social media or comfortable posting, you know, publicly, especially when it involves their children. And I can respect that because, you know, I never did that when mine were younger. But on every level, personally, through other people anecdotally, through established channels, it seems like people are really embracing the book and I guess the aims of the book. I'm thrilled because I just posted about this morning. There's a lot of people telling me they're using it in very kind of ingenious, creative ways, which is interesting. You know, like playing games based on the book, trying to develop in class a kind of like utopian, but not really quite utopian society. Like I think they called it a community of caring, where they were kind of signing up for what their ideal society would be like, how they would be and how they would treat other people. So that's just always, you know, very heartening as an author and a creator when you feel like your work is resonating and that people get it and are able to access it and use it however they want. There's no right or wrong way to use it. It's whatever speaks to them.
That's exciting that there's some real life impact there as well from your work. And especially in those formative years, because I think, yeah, in childhood, there's a lot of life that seems out of your own control as well. Starting to think about how your own behavior can impact other people is interesting.
It's a lot of out of control as an adult too. I think it continues over time. And that was actually part of why I wrote the book. Because when I was younger, different era then, obviously, but We were just told what to do. You know, very strict background. I won't go into detail because people just cannot fathom. And I don't think this was a New York thing. I think it was around the world. It was just a different time, but maybe it was in America, maybe it was in the city. But adults were telling you what to do at every step of the way. At home, you were told what to do. At school, you were told what to do. If you went out to the shops, strangers or neighbors are telling you what to do. If you're too noisy, or don't run there, and don't go into the street, and don't swim after you've just eaten. And when it came to moral decisions or right or wrong, there was no reasoning. It was just your parents saying, don't do that because I told you, because that's wrong. There was no like, hey, let's just take time and nut this out. And I had one of those brains that needed to nut it out. That's kind of like a blessing and a curse. I'm still like that. And I wanted to drive it myself. You know, I wasn't happy with the nuns every Sunday in Sunday school class, basically just telling us the way it was. And if you had a question like, oh, that doesn't quite make sense, because you just said earlier, you're sent out of the classroom. So I wanted to try to give kids the tools. And that's kind of part of, I guess, the reason for this book, the rationale, and hopefully one of the strengths. Better for kids to try to work it out in a safe and supportive environment with their families than to just be told, memorize these things or do what I said because of consequences or because I told you so.
And do you have a favorite letter in the book? Is there a virtue you like best?
I don't have a favorite. They're kind of all favorites, but I thought, oh, what's M for my name, Maura? And it's mindful. And I thought, oh, I mean, the odd thing is when I look at the book, and this was not intentional by any means, when I look at the names of the people in my family, they kind of describe us to the T. My eldest, Aiden, it has no fear. You know, he would have gone bungee jumping at age 2 if we let him. So A for adventurous, L for Liam, loyal, diehard loyal, great, you know, like that's just him. Me, mindful, my brain, like sometimes you just get lost. There's a whole world there. My husband, Kieran, he's the kind one. K for kind, so he's just so laid back and so lovely and so kind. And E for Erin, my daughter, engaged. She's always busy, always has been. You know, when you have kids and they're little and they're like, they seem almost fully formed, their personalities and just their vibe, who they are. And then you see them as adults and they're kind of very, like, much different because they grow, but just so much that same essence, you know, that little spark from when they were young. I like mindful because I think I tend to do too much. My life has always been too busy. I kind of don't laugh, but I think, oh, you know, when people say like, oh, I'm so busy, I had to work till 6, and I think, oh, God, would you know that. It's all relative, and we're all, you know, so that's not a competition, but. I mean, I've had 4 side gigs since I was 13, probably, and I'm quite old now. So you just get tired over time, but you get so used to it, and that becomes a habit. And I don't think it's a virtue. I used to think it was doing all these things, you know, trying to do them well, trying to just explore opportunities, learn, very curious. But then there comes a point where you have to say, why am I doing this? Who am I doing it for? And am I doing it well? And is there a cost for me doing it? And am I missing a lot along the way? So for me, mindful is an important one, to just stop and breathe, to not feel like I have to produce. I think that comes from childhood, you know, because I was a good student. I just had a lot of expectations put on me, even inadvertently by parents, teachers, and others. So you just get used to that cycle and, you know, trying to still pursue a lot of interests, to keep a brain active, important as you get older, not define yourself in terms of what you produce or do, but making it a point of trying to really enjoy the people and, you know, just the world, you know, along the way.
Well, that being present for the people you love is important as well, especially when you've got growing children. If you're always saying, I'm too busy, I'm too busy, that's the message that they get, that they're not important to you, that the other things are important. And it's a challenge to also communicate, well, especially if you're a working mum, you have to work to support your family, but you don't want your family to think that they're not important to you. So it's that cycle you get trapped in.
With technology, you know, and just advances, we're meant to be, I guess, living a better, easier life. But to me, we're busier than ever. You know, so the things that are meant to be an asset to help us navigate busyness have created a hunger and insatiable demand for content, no matter how trivial, whether factually incorrect. You know, it doesn't really matter. We just now live in a world where our psyches are being kind of modeled on, I just need to be connected. I need to see. I need to chase. Like, I'll look at a few reels and an hour and a half later, because you're lost in that, you know, reward cycle.
Because time stands still when you're looking at your phone and your whole body and mind is focused on that screen and things go on around you.
I know,
and it's really, it can suck you right in.
I remember when the kids were growing up, there were a lot, I've never shied away from conversation with anyone, like strangers, friends, family, our kids. And I remember thinking when they would come home one day, there might have been an issue at school. Like, we emerged relatively unscathed. You know, they had, even though academically they were probably at the wrong school for the type of students they were always socially embedded quite well. And I think that served as a support for them in life. But there's always issues that come up with kids, especially in teenage years. And I remember a lot of times thinking, like, oh, this is like the ideal opportunity to sit and talk about, I don't know, tolerance or friendship or something. But, you know, it's like 6:15, who's making dinner? There's no food. Someone needs help with homework. You need to bang out a few emails for work. So it's hard to have the luxury of time, even if you have the intent and the desire, to sit and talk to kids about issues like these. And Alphabet, you know, and to bring it back to the book indirectly, is a resource for people who might not know how to navigate those conversations with kids. You know, when my eldest would come home, two boys, the girl is the youngest, and you'd say, you know, what happened at school today? I'd always wait a respectable half hour or 45 minutes to let him decompress, but just try to be casual. Hey, what happened at school? Nothing. What'd you do? Nothing. You know,
a standard answer.
Oh, my God. I need a bit of info, because I assume everything's okay unless they're telling me otherwise. But if I walked the dog with my eldest son, who was probably very vocal but not about those types of things, it just poured out of him. I had to kind of get to him in the right context, in the right setting, probably when he was relaxed. He was a very sensory kind of responsive person. So the environment was crucially important. It took me quite a while to work that out. My other son, I was finding it most meaningful to try to approach tasks with him creatively, because he had that kind of brain. You know, so it's just, it's not easy. It's not the kind of thing you can say, hey, tonight, kids, we're going to talk about ethics. Let's talk about values. You know, let's talk about what you do at school. Okay, let's look it up on page 18. It's not that kind of thing. It's better if it's kind of just organic and sitting in the back of your mind, and it's a book you can dip into as the need arises, as you see fit.
I think, especially with children, those conversations are always happening side by side to something else. Like, if you're doing, even with my son driving in the car to take him somewhere, that's where the most conversations happen for us, while he's sitting next to me, not quite looking directly at my face, and things will pop up. But yeah, while you're doing other tasks with your family, that's when those conversations tend to happen. But if you sat them down and said, okay, house meeting, let's talk about this, it would not work.
Exactly. And kids learn, like, their value system mainly by modeling, you know, the behavior of the adults in their lives. And for the most part, that's parents, grandparents, and teachers, you know, educators. It could be a soccer coach, neighbors, you know, a carers, etc. So yeah, the actions definitely speak louder than words. So that's very true.
So now, if people would like to find Alphabet, where can they buy it from?
They should be able to buy it from their local bookstore. If the bookstore doesn't have stock, they could definitely order it in. It's available really everywhere that you would expect it to be available. It's available online at online retailers. It's available at local independent bookshops. It's available at the larger chains. And if they've run out, which apparently some have,
Oh, that's
they should be
exciting. Well
able.
done.
Yeah. So they should be able. Well, that's just, some that I've heard of anecdotally. I'm not trying to imply, that there's a run on it, but although that'd be nice. So they should be able to find it. I think there's a link on my Instagram, at Pirlo underscore author. There's a few links in my Instagram profile for how to buy if anyone's interested.
Fantastic. Now I've got a few quick fire questions that I ask all my guests just so our listeners can get to know you a little bit better.
Should have done my homework before I came on. Okay.
They're all
Try.
about you, so it's fine. You should
Aye,
know the
aye.
answers. So what was your favorite book growing up?
Little Women.
Great book. If you could be any book character, who would it be?
I not to double up, but I would probably say I'm torn between Meg and Jo, one of the Little Women characters. Yeah, I'm not sure.
They're both excellent characters. I'd probably pick Jo, but
Yeah, I wanted to say Jo, but I think Meg's kind of sometimes overlooked. Anyway.
yes. Have you got something that you're reading right now?
I do. I'm reading. Oh my God, I'm going to sound like really boringly academic. The Choice of Hercules, Pleasure, Duty, and the Good Life in the 21st Century by A.C. Grayling. He's a well-known British philosopher, thinker. It sounds a bit la-di-da, esoteric, but it's a very user-friendly, kind of provocative, very interesting and easy read. About some of the issues that underpin Alphabetter. I picked that up after. I probably should have picked it up before I read Alphabetter, but
I might be able to write a second one now.
Alphabetter too.
Now, if you could invite five literary people to dinner, who would they be?
Oh, five literary people. I might have to Five literary. I would definitely invite J.D. Salinger. I assume we don't need. You're not referring to characters. They could be authors.
You can have characters or authors. I am worried that J.D. Salinger will decline, though.
He would decline, which is why I would insist he be there. I'm attracted by the mystery and kind of the dark side of his brain. I think there's some commonality there. I would definitely invite Hemingway because I think he's a
Yes.
character. I would definitely invite Hunter S. Thompson, inventor of gonzo journalism. We can't say no. There's quite a few that don't quite count as literary. I would definitely invite Susan Sontag. And also, oh my God, I'm having a seniors moment. She's one of my favorite kind of memoir essayists. Please help me. I'm looking at, not Susan.
It's okay to Google if you need to.
No, sorry. Her, for the New York, oh my goodness. I can find it and send it. Oh my goodness, this is embarrassing.
How about a philosopher? Is there any philosophers you would have?
Yeah, well, there would be Aristotle. He's my favorite if it's not obvious. Although A.C. Grayling would be quite a good dinner companion. I'm struck by how this is, unintentionally male, a lot of these figures, which is surprising to me. Oh my goodness. The author I'm thinking of, her husband died, The Year of Magical Thinking. Year of Magical Thinking. I am going to Google. Sorry, Kai.
That's
I should have
okay.
presented, had 3 hours sleep last night, so I
Oh,
think
no.
The Year of Magical Thinking. Oh God, she's so well known.
Joan Didion?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Google to the
Yes. Oh
rescue.
God. Thank you. My favorite. Yeah, I just love her writing. I mean, I love Anne Tyler. There's a lot of people I love. Joyce Carol Oates. I mean, there's just so many. But sorry, my brain's not in quick response mode today
No, that's
for
fine.
reasons
Mine
I bore
rarely
you with.
is.
Yeah, please bring me with that.
And just as a thought that's popped into my head, what do you think Aristotle would think of your book?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think he would like it. I think Aristotle's, devoted most of his life to nutting out a lot of these issues. I mean, his Nicomachean Ethics is close to 800 pages. So it wasn't like a light task or just something to do because he had time. It was almost like the point of life for him was to try to explore and make sense of these issues so that you can make sense of the world, so you can make sense of why you're here and what your purpose is and how you derive meaning. And I've always had a similar quest, which, as I said earlier, I always thought in a sense was a blessing to be so curious and engaged with the world, but it can definitely be a curse. At times you can overthink, you can dive a bit too deep. I think with Aristotle, anything like this book that could be used to facilitate these types of discussions, I think he would wholeheartedly embrace. And I think it's hard because I think, as we said earlier, it doesn't come easy for some families to talk. I came from a family that we didn't talk about a lot of this kind of thing. In those days, you just didn't. The personal stuff, you just kind of kept your cards close to your chest. You talked about the day-to-day things. So I know a lot of families these days that just aren't comfortable having those kind of discussions. Others want to, but just don't know how. So just to bring it to the forefront, to say ethics isn't necessarily what you think it is. It's not someone telling you what to do. It's not an outcome or choosing the right act. It's like developing a sensibility so that you kind of know and have the critical reasoning to navigate different choices, weigh them up, think of the consequences of your actions on others, and choose accordingly. And I think Aristotle would think, what a great way, it's never too early to start. What a great resource to help make that happen.
Fantastic. And just one last question. Now, Alphabetta is not your only work of writing that you've published. What advice would you give yourself if you could go back to the beginning of your writing career?
I think the advice I would give myself is to cut yourself a break and be kind to yourself above all, because I think I drove myself a bit too hard in this quest to bring work to the market. I started off, I've been writing all my life, but for other people, boring things like policy, legislation, advertising, that kind of thing. But I always wanted to do more creative writing, and I only really started to do that seriously about 10 years ago. And perhaps because I was older at the time, I thought like, oh, I don't have a lot of time. I better, just whip through all these, grand ideas that I have. I was lucky I won quite a few awards early on, but I think that messed me up a bit because I thought by virtue of winning awards, the path to publication would be a lot easier than it was in fact. And that's when I learned more about the market, that it doesn't really matter how great your writing is or isn't. I mean, you could have a beautiful book, you could have beautiful words, publishers could love it. I won young adult novel, I'm still trying to place. It's like every time it wins something, I'm almost disheartened because I'm thinking, oh, how lovely, yet I'm not one step closer to publication. And publishers typically say like, oh, we laughed, we cried, we love it, how beautiful, well, prose is beautiful, but there's always a but. It's really more the commercial reality. I've been in business for over 2 decades. I know, I mean, publishers are risk averse and rightly so. They need to know that they can recoup their costs, let alone make money, or no one has a job and there's no publisher and there's no one to submit to, and I get that. But I think looking back, I would tell myself, I started off saying it's not about publication, but when you write and you get great feedback on your work, then you start to think it deserves to be published, and that's a mistake. I don't think anything deserves to be published. I don't think there's really any merit in it. I think it's a combination of good writing, If it's great writing, that helps, but doesn't guarantee anything. At the right place, on the right issues, for the right market, with the right set of eyes, assessing it at the right time. And that's a lot.
It can be difficult to become a salesperson of your work when the creation of it, like I find so much joy when I've written something good, and then to go, oh, I love this, it felt great to create, now I have to change my mindset and sell this piece of work. And it kind of, that part of the process doesn't feel artistic or creative.
It's not, it's the business end. And ironically, I got out of business. I mean, I'm still, like, if you have businesses, like, you're always involved in some capacity. But I got out of the day-to-day side of our business, only to be thrown into a new kind of business with a different level, you know, but same kind of headaches, same kind of challenges. But what I found even more challenging was I could sell your book easy. I would love to, you know, sing the praises. But I find it very difficult to sell my own because I feel like, oh, you know, I tend to downplay. Oh, it's just a little book. Oh, look, it's like, oh, my God, we love it. I'm like, oh, yeah, it's okay. I automatically go the opposite, probably because I don't want to. I don't know. There's so many people who are so full of self-importance.
Being humble is challenging. Because supposedly it's meant to be good to be humble, but it's not good for yourself necessarily at times.
I don't know how you strike the balance. We need to find a virtue chi, Aristotle would say. Strive between the mean. It's like for the mean, I don't know. Yes, because too humble, there are people who are, there's false humility, and then there are people who are truly humble that, you know, you find out accidentally they've written five books because you'd hardly know because they hardly talk about it. They'll just do, you know, what they can within the context of, you know, their life. I don't know. I don't think there's a playbook. I know there are a lot of people who are just grossly uncomfortable speaking in public or dealing with people, and I can respect that. And there are others who probably love it too much. And we'll go on and on. I think the journey is unique for each person. And sometimes when I go to conferences, which I don't really much anymore for lack of time, COVID kind of did my head in. You know, I think I'm still kind of in post-COVID mode in a lot of ways. But I think I found, because I'm cynical by nature, I think I found it difficult to hear, to front up Canberra's not far away, but, you know, it's usually an effort to get to it somewhere else for a conference. Rarely are they here. I guess I didn't identify with a lot of the journeys necessarily because they were just so unique to the people who were telling their tale. And that's fine, but it was told in a prescriptive form as though that was the way it should be. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be someone who's been published and says, this is now what you need to do based on my learnings. I tend to resile. Again, it's like that childhood thing, you know, people telling you what to do, how to be, how to act, what you need to do. I'm happy to take advice. But I think everyone has to necessarily carve their own path. And you can take little glimmerings and you could take learnings from people that you identify with when their stories resonate. But there's no right or wrong. And if you did everything they said that they did, you still probably wouldn't be published because you're a different person at a different time with a different piece of work in a different market. But it's still, I think, a sense of solidarity that we can share the pitfalls and the joys, you know, when they happen.
Well, I think it's, I don't know about you, Maura, but I have like an existential crisis nearly every week where I'm going, what am I doing this for? This is almost like torture sometimes where you're submitting and not getting any answers, or you're having to put yourself out in the public eye to promote your book, but that's not your natural state. So you're like, why am I doing this? But the best thing I can do is write. So I feel like I have to do it, but there is that time where I just stop and go, well, I don't want to necessarily be famous, but I do want to share my art And so it can be really challenging.
We're definitely kindred spirits because I came into this very late in the day after many careers and approaching retirement age. And I thought I need to do something creative because in all of our work in business, which went well, even though I could occasionally be creative with marketing, it wasn't really creative business. It was real estate and finance. So I felt like I had lost a bit of myself. I had kids late in life. I was 38, 40, and 42 when I had our kids. You necessarily go through changes as a mother. When you hit menopause, that can really mess you up, depending, on how severe and your outlook and the way you're wired. And I started writing as a way of writing my way through and out of issues that I was trying to make sense of. But then somewhere along the way, that morphed into a, I'm not competitive with other people. Like, it doesn't worry me. Like, I'm thrilled if anyone has success, whether I know them or not, couldn't be happier. But I'm very competitive with myself. I've always been that way. And it kind of turned into, and I told friends, I'm not writing. I couldn't give a shit if I'm published. That's just not, like, I don't want a bestseller. I don't want to go on the circuit. I don't want to be famous. That would be horrifying to me. I just want to write meaningful things for me because that's how I've been all my life. I'd write missives to ex-boyfriend to boyfriends if there was an issue. I would never give it to them. I'd rip up the letter, but just that act of putting pen to paper crystallized everything for me. So I've always been text-based, but somehow that turned into this, I don't know, like, what, this isn't me. Why am I here? Why am I doing this? Why am I making my life difficult? Like, I could actually just be picking avocados now and like doing some farm work and going to the beach and relaxing, and seeing friends. But I'm taking on these deadlines and these challenges. And then in the face of that, to cut a long story short, from when I first started 3 years later, and I was just finding my way, my husband became gravely ill suddenly and nearly died and took 2 years to recover. I was thrown back into the family business that I spent 5 years through menopause trying to get out of. Our kids were navigating high school, and there are various issues attached to that. My mother was dying and she was overseas, so there's like a 26-hour flight. So I'm trying to be a carer, be back in business. My mother had dementia and underlying mental health issues that were never quite diagnosed, which raised a lot of family issues and a little bit of angst. And then she died. My husband rebounded over 2 years. And I said, it can't get much worse than all of that and the menopause mix and everything. I thought, like, oh my God, I'm like, every day I felt like, is this what a nervous breakdown feels like? When you feel like, I knew it wasn't, not to overstate, but you feel detached from who you are. And just lose a bit of your oomph, which is normal, but it becomes embedded. And no sooner did that happen, I thought it couldn't get much worse, that the bushfires hit and we were like poised to evacuate. So, and if you have underlying anxiety, and you're just finally catching your breath and you're, not at the face of the fire, but you're watching on the map it come towards you, that's not a great kind of place to be. And then we jokingly said, after we got through that, it can't get any worse. And then
That's
COVID hit.
it.
And then COVID, and I'm like, can I swear? I'm not going to swear or anything, but I went, effing hell, are you kidding me? And then that turned into this whole, oh God, if you have anxiety, I could easily now become agoraphobic just for measure. Because the world, same thing happened to me with 9/11 when I just had my third child. I got home from hospital, middle of the night, my husband's waking me, it's on TV, and I thought it was a Die Hard movie. And I thought, please just let me sleep. I was so, exhausted with the third one. And then I woke up and, I saw my neighborhood kind of crumble and the whole world changed. It was like my outlook, my paradigm
Must have
for
been
existence changed.
devastating.
So I felt like that was happening again with COVID. And all through the way, writer friends that I knew, maybe not with that kind of background and context, were saying they were getting rejected and this happened, they lost out on this and they still haven't had this thing published. And I was seeing, probably because I was more sensitive to the mental health side of things after going through what I went through with my mother, myself, just being a bit challenged at times through all this, I started seeing the mental health end of people aspiring to have their work published. And I thought, well, there's no field like literary psychologist, but I swear to God, there should be a specialty, because I think there are mental health ramifications of working in an industry where every day you're indirectly being told you're not good enough. And you work, and I'm not trying to overstate. I mean, that's life. We all work in, like, I've had, a lot of challenges professionally, whatever. I mean, and that's part of being a grown up. But just, the nature of it. Some publishers still don't acknowledge receipt. Some still want exclusivity. Some don't honor time frames. Some give feedback that's kind of brutal and maybe not productive. And I can pretty much handle anything. But I think my worry was more for people who maybe, when you're firing off feedback to someone or saying something, you don't know what their day has been, what their life is, who they are, how they're wired, what they're bringing, like, to the table for this. So I saw a few people come undone. And I think that, I don't know, just made me a little bit more skeptical, I guess, about, let's just say, I think things can be done better. I think if you look philosophically, not to bring it back to that, if publishers could walk a day in an aspiring writer's shoes, I think that would be worthwhile. Getting those letters, rejections, the feedback that may or may not be presented in the best possible context or way. And
or
likewise,
if it's just not right for them, that doesn't help in any way. It's like, okay, well, what do I change though?
I mean, criticism is hard to take, and it's good to be honest. And I think, even when I look at book reviews, there's never any bad book reviews, because no one's going to write a bad book review. They're not really reviews. They're really testimonials for a book, because no one's going to say, well, this one didn't really do much for me, or this one, I would have loved to have seen this, because that'll affect sales, and then that scene is not a good thing. It's good if people feel that they can speak directly and frankly. I'm all for that in a respectful, open way. But I've read some, dealings that people have had, little snippets they've received from, it's not even publishers, it's more manuscript assessors. And one had said, you're not a very good writer. That's obvious.
Which
that effect. Yeah, and I think because they were so appalled by the manuscript or the state of the manuscript, you need a lot more help than you think you do. Now, they're probably just on a busy day trying to bang out a quick assessment, and they're trying to help them, and I've no doubt about that. But if they knew the story of that person receiving those words at that time, those words can... Well, words are powerful, and I just think if we could have a more holistic view, if writers could walk in a publisher's shoes for a day, I think that would be worthwhile, because it's nothing personal when they get rejected. It's just certain economic and commercial realities. But I don't think we talk frankly about that. I think, there's a lot of nicely, and let's keep up appearances, and it's easier not to go there. So, the saga continues.
It is interesting, the drive that you can have as a writer as well to get published, though, because I have quite a complex life. I've got two sons with autism. I work full time and everything's a bit crazy. And in the cracks, I'm podcasting and trying to get books published and entering competitions. And I went and saw a counsellor, and she said, you're creating all of that for yourself. You don't have to do any of that. You don't have to write, you don't have to enter a competition, you don't have to submit to a publisher. And I changed psychologists.
Did
So
you?
I was like, but that is who I want to be. So I'm going to keep doing that. And even though it is a lot to handle, the only way to get published or to write and create art is to sit down and do it. So I was like, okay, that's an interesting thing about me, that I went, no, I'm not going to take that advice to make my life a little bit easier. I still want to pursue what inspires me. So, yeah, I
And
just was
true.
like, no, I don't think I can accept that advice.
Well, that's smart that you couldn't, and good on you for seeing someone else, because a lot of people might have walked away. That's the problem. They might think, oh, if it's not working, I'll remove myself from the stressful situation. I would rather spend time trying to work out how I can survive, let alone thrive, in a process and an industry that's not perfect, you know, that has two competing tensions, artistic and commercial. And there's always going to be, you know, a less than ideal way that they're hammered out. There's always going to be people who can't bring their work to the market. There's always going to be some work that gets through commercially that you go, really, that's the best you could do. But it satisfies some commercial need. You know, it might be seen as trivial, or it could be someone, a celebrity with a large following, so they can move units. The topic itself might not change mankind. You know, not that we have to. You know, literature and books don't have to be life-affirming or life-changing. They can be just simply entertaining, and there's room for everyone. But I think on an individual level, depending on your backstory, how you're wired, what your aspirations are, it can be very, very, very tricky to navigate without losing sight of who you are. And I've been strict from the beginning. I hated social media. It took me forever to get on it, begrudgingly. I do it. I don't think I do it well. I don't care when I post. I don't try to get the tips to do it better. It has to work for me in my life. It can't dominate my life. I don't want to care that much. I'm not going to schedule my day around, I need to post at 3 o'clock, and it needs to be this kind of faceless post because I did these three posts earlier. That's the day I would walk away, when I was bound so heavily to technology. And same with publishers. There are some I've walked away from, smaller ones, when they offered deals that I just thought were unfair and unconscionable for what they were asking. So I knew early on, I don't want to be published just to be published, come what may. I'm not going to sell my soul. No way. But I think for me, like, you could have a beautiful painting and think, wow, I made this, even if no one sees it. To me, there's still some beauty and meaning in the act of producing that. But you kick it up a level when you then have an audience and someone engaging with that work. Whether you meet them or not is irrelevant, because then your art lives through them and what they take from it and how they enter and kind of go through the world with that little kernel of knowledge, having seen your painting, having commented, having met someone as a result, whatever the story is. I think because the work that I write, and I'm not implying it's good or better than what anyone else writes, but just for me, the way I'm wired, the stories I want to tell, they all have an existential theme. They're all work that goes to the heart of the human condition. And even though I derive a lot of meaning and satisfaction from producing them from myself, there's like this extra meaning that I love when other people engage with it, and then also engage with me on the basis of that. So I'm just trying to, it's like balls in the air, juggle and manage those different kind of sensibilities for why I produce art, how I do it, how it has to make sense in my world, how it can't overtake my world, but it's necessarily an expression of who I am. And just getting it out there for people to engage with, you know, is easier said than done. You know, I have a film that I got a grant for, a web series based on a play that I wrote, mental health themes for young people, critically acclaimed, award-winning, toured festivals here and overseas. It's just now a feature-length film, but it's all how to now get a deal to bring it to the public. I would have to almost devote, it's going to become my life's mission to try to get a distributor, which is like an ordeal and not easy to do, and I'm not embedded in the industry, so I wouldn't even know where to start. Mm-hmm. But I have this beautifully meaningful work that seems to move people, but how many people can I tell? I mean, I can post ad nauseum, but I have a limited following, so that's kind of the plight, I guess, of art. And you could spend your life trying to make the right contacts and have the right networks and nurture them to get your message out there, but then that doesn't leave you a lot of time to create your art. So I don't know the answer. I just know there's challenges there, and there probably always will be, and tensions, but we just do the best we can to keep our sanity and to not lose your joy in creating. It was starting to become a burden for me. Like, oh my God, I have to finish that. I would set the deadline, accept the challenge, make it happen. And then I would almost torture myself and berate myself for having, like, why am I losing sleep? Why am I working flat out? Why am I doing four things at once? Like, I'm the one doing this to myself. Mm. So I had to kind of look at, I think for me, I wanted or needed to be validated somehow. Mm. And I think that had something to do with other things in life. You know, maybe not so much writing. I don't know. That's still a work in progress.
I think we're a work in progress all our lives.
Yes, definitely.
Always learning, always growing.
Definitely.
It sounds like Alpha Beta might be the perfect book for me to start with in exploring philosophy.
I hope you do. I'd be curious what you think. I think it's a book that is easy to engage with, however you want to, anyone of any age. And the beauty is a child could read it on their own, but it's a great book for families to sit and read together. But it's also a great book to pick apart in the classroom, because there's just so many layers that can be explored. And I just hope that gives a sense of meaning and solace, I think philosophy can, to people. Mm-hmm. You know, thinking through the issues, it doesn't matter if you don't have the answers. It's the ability to ask questions that's the important thing, rather than just give what's spoon-fed, accept face value, assume it must be true because you saw it on the internet. It's to develop those critical skills where you go, wait, that doesn't add up, or that doesn't stack, but I don't see that as being me. I'd rather, how can I do this instead? Or what would this mean if, you know, I was presented with this choice or dilemma? How would I navigate through that? So hope it helps people.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Maura. And I'm going to direct everyone to go and find your book in their local bookshop or in their library to start their journey on philosophy.
Thanks so much, Kai. It's been a pleasure.
Totally Lit is an independent podcast. You can help support us to continue to chat with wonderful Australian creatives by leaving a review on iTunes or sharing our socials with your friends. You can also make a contribution at www.buymeacoffee.com/totallylit. This will also help with equipment and podcasting platform fees. I love to interact with our listeners, so feel free to say hello either by email or social media. You can email me at totallylitpodcast@gmail.com, or you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn and Twitter. I've also created the group Totally Lit Writing Community on Facebook. It's a space to continue the conversation and share your writing successes, events, launches and latest projects. Jump into the group and say hello. I love to share lots of opportunities on there, so writing competitions, anthology call-outs, publishing opportunities. So jump into the group and say hello. Thank you for listening to Totally Lit, and don't forget to go out into the world to read, write, create, ignite.